In September of 1995, leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints put their position on gender and sexuality into a formal document, a proclamation to the world, they called it. The scholar Taylor Petrie says this proclamation cemented Mormon teachings about the family. It codified heterosexual marriage. It declared gender as an essential characteristic, an eternal identity. What that means is that your gender, your sexuality, is fixed by God and always has been. But Petrie says this wasn't always the teaching of Mormon leaders. Ideas about sexuality and gender, he says, used to be different, quite different, and not really that long ago.
So in the 1950s, one of the prominent general authorities is a man named Joseph Fielding Smith. And he does this thing where he's inviting members of the church to sort of write him letters. And as a doctrinal and scriptural authority, he's going to then respond and give them the answers to their questions. And among them, there are a couple that are really dealing with the questions of gender and sexuality in the afterlife. So one member writes to Joseph Fielding Smith and says, you know, we're having this debate in my Sunday school class recently, and I wonder if you could settle it. And the issue is, what about all of these people who in the next life are not going to be married? They weren't sealed in Latter-day Saint temples. They don't benefit from those blessings. They haven't been righteous enough in order to keep their marriages in the next life. And so they're all going to be single. Aren't all of these unrighteous single people in the next life going to be just engaged in all sorts of illicit sexual activity in the next life? Latter-day Saints had this very materialistic, real understanding of afterlife. You know, you would be doing all kinds of things like you would be doing here. It's not like you're just singing in choirs all the time, right? You're doing stuff. And one of those things that you might be doing in the next life includes sexual intercourse. And there's this real worry about the possibilities of illicit sexual intercourse in the next life. And the fascinating thing about the way that Joseph Fielding Smith answers this question is actually to turn the question around to say, what's going to happen in the next life isn't illicit sex, because it won't be possible, because the vast majority of people in the next life, those who aren't in the celestial kingdom and those whose marriages are not preserved, are not going to have their genitals. They're not going to be male or female. We're just going to get rid of sexuality by getting rid of sexual difference. And all of these people are going to be neither male nor female. And so he's not at all appealing to some idea of an eternal gender that many Latter-day Saints hold on to today, but quite the opposite. Gender is going to be something that only a few people are going to be able to have in the next life.
So Joseph Fielding Smith is thinking about the details, about your genitals. How does this illustrate a moment in time in thinking for Mormon leaders?
It shows that these ideas that gender is eternal, that we eventually are going to get, were not worked out. And we see this notion of a contingent gender where you're not guaranteed it. And so they see things like feminism. They see things like homosexuality. They're looking around in the world and they're seeing all these things that are weakening the kind of strict differences between male and female that society had upheld up until that point. And they see those things as emblematic of what the lower levels of the next life are going to look like. And they warn Latter-day Saints that if you're not careful, you're going to lose your maleness or your femaleness. When I first went into this project, I expected to find that Latter-day Saint ideas about gender and sexuality had been pretty stable, but that just wasn't showing up. When you look at the past, it tells a different story, and that story I felt like really needed to be told.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Taylor Petrie is with us to talk about how Mormon teaching and theology about gender and sexuality has undergone what he calls a remarkable transformation, and really just since the end of World War II. His book is called Tabernacles of Clay. Petrie is a professor of religion at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. He's also a Latter-day Saint, and he told us his church's opposition to same-sex marriage and public campaigns like Proposition 8 in California raised some difficult personal questions for him.
Proposition 8 happened while I was in graduate school, and it turned out to be a little bit of a difficult issue for me and certainly many of the other people that I was going to church with. It was a national conversation, as everyone recalls. You know, it wasn't just a California or even a Utah thing. I mean, when I was living in Massachusetts at the time, same-sex marriage had been legal already for a number of years. And so we were a little bit jarred by the church taking this position. It seemed a little more aggressive than we had expected, more than we were maybe used to. Now that I've been able to study the issue, I'm not surprised at all by what was going down in 2008. But it really did shock me at the time, and it was something that I really needed to wrestle with. And so that was when I began more seriously thinking about the connections between the things that I was studying around gender and sexuality and religion and my own faith and my own tradition, and wanting to tell that story in a little bit more sophisticated way than had been done up until that point.
You say when you went looking for a good history of these Mormon concepts of gender and sexuality, that you just didn't really find much. And I wonder why you think that is, why it is that this big subject hasn't been broached, at least in the way you think it should have been by now.
In part, it's because many of the historians that have come at this before have not necessarily been trained in gender studies and haven't been asking these kinds of questions. You know, that's not to fault the great historians. I'm certainly drawing on and building on the work that has been done by so many fascinating and fantastic scholars before me. But I think that the kinds of questions that I was interested in asking weren't really being taken seriously by many of these other historians, that they were sort of telling the stories of how women's roles were being challenged or gay and lesbian rights being challenged. And those are all important aspects of the story. But I wanted to talk about how Latter-day Saints were even thinking about gender and thinking about sexuality as concepts themselves. And so I tried to bring those questions in. And I think that those questions ended up revealing a quite different story than many other historians have told about this period.
Yeah. I mean, when you first started uncovering all of this and realizing that Latter-day Saint leaders used to preach about, talk about sex and gender as more fluid, as more malleable, were you surprised given what you knew at the time or given what's actually out there right now?
I was surprised. I was mostly surprised at how recent it was that those things were happening. In part because, as I said, most of the historians and you know, I don't want to pick on any one particular person, but there were a lot of people who were writing about this and saying LDS teachings on gender and sexuality haven't really changed, that there hasn't really been a development of thought on this, that there's been actually a lot of consistency. And I knew as a historian of sexuality and in the other field that I work in early Christianity, that there was just no way that that was possibly true, right? People's ideas about gender and sexuality are always changing. And so I expected, of course, when I started looking at LDS thought about this, that there would be changes. I wasn't prepared for, first of all, how radical in some respects those ideas were relative to contemporary LDS teachings and how recent they were. When I looked at this, when I thought I would find some things, I thought, oh, I'm going to find some great crazy stuff in the 19th century. And it turned out, no, it was in the 1960s and 70s and 1980s that you're finding this stuff, much more recent than I expected, given the time period and sort of the assumptions about the present that we have about what LDS teachings about gender and sexuality actually are.
I want to ask about history, the history part. You say this idea that Mormonism is committed to these traditional ideas about sexuality has this specific history. So let's talk a little bit about this. What was the early thinking about, let's just say gender first, the idea of gender? And let's go to the founder. Let's go to Joseph Smith and certainly some of the other leaders. How are they thinking about, how are they talking about, if they are at all in those times, about the nature of gender, about the sense of sexuality?
They aren't articulating it in quite those terms yet. I mean, as Joseph Smith, for instance, is developing his own theology and he comes to believe in a material God and a God who is ultimately a sort of former human who has now been risen to the status of a God. And these are somewhat underdeveloped ideas in his late stage. And you know, he's not really thinking about gender in the way that we would think about separate gender roles and so on. There's some evidence, of course, that he's, you know, toying with the idea of priesthood as something that women would also be participating in. And he's developing these ideas. They're all really underdeveloped and underdetermined in during this time period. And he, of course, is assassinated at this time. So we don't really see how he might have taken all of those. But he does seem, and many of his early followers, probably P. Pratt and others, are believing in this material god that is engaged in sexual reproduction. And to the extent that they are kind of adopting those ideas at the same time that they're also developing ideas about plural marriage, the early ideas that they're having around this are very much based on a kind of hierarchy between the sexes. And so where we do see that developing, again, there are places where you could push back and where Joseph Smith might be toying with some other thoughts here. But the notion of plural marriage and the notion of patriarchy and the notion of a kind of patriarchal order that Latter-day Saints then in the Utah period and up through the end of plural marriage are drawing on, is this idea of hierarchy. And that's a really central idea that lasts up until really the modern period of the church, and in some ways is certainly still informing the way that the church structures itself around priesthood and so on. But it has very much weakened that idea when it comes to marriage in the modern church. But this notion of a kind of patriarchal system, one where there's a male at the head in that case in the 19th century over several women, right? Now it's then just one wife in the monogamous era, or maybe two or three, depending on how many people you've married successively, right? The question of whether or not plural marriage exists in the afterlife is certainly an open issue in contemporary Latter-day Saint thought. But that issue of a kind of patriarchal idea really does show up, I think, as a core in Joseph Smith's thinking, and certainly in the way that his ideas are developed afterward. And one that's kind of immovable for many Latter-day Saints up until the modern period, when it starts to get greatly chipped away at and weakened, and we sort of end up with a much softer version of that patriarchy.
One of the things you write about is, you know, you talk about there was a great deal of contingency and sexual difference throughout the Mormon story. And there was a time when Mormon leaders taught or believed that in this pre-existent spirit world that Latter-day Saints believe in, that people actually chose their gender. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we see this showing up in teachings in the 1960s and 70s and in general conference and in other addresses that Latter-day Saints are writing and speaking about. And they are not only speculating about the nature of sexual difference in the afterlife, as Joseph Fielding Smith was, but before one was born. And there's a central problem that they're working out, right? And it has to do with, if there is a hierarchy between male and female, and again, this is a time when the patriarchal order was really a central teaching in the church. If there's a hierarchy, on what basis would it be just to sort of assign people to it within that hierarchy? So if women are lower on the status, wouldn't it be unjust for God to have created the hierarchy? And they come up with this answer, which is that, well, you chose which one you wanted to be. Therefore, there's no injustice because you chose it. And you might notice that this is the exact same answer that they're giving about race and the priesthood during the same time period as well. That the reason why some people don't have priesthood, women and Black people, is because of the choices that they made. Now, again, to be a woman wasn't necessarily a sinful choice that somebody made, that they're imagining a sinful choice in the afterlife, but rather that people sort of tended maybe towards one or the other, that they actively chose that they wanted to take on the role of motherhood or they wanted to take on the role of priesthood. So you start to get this dichotomy, this division of roles that were developed, and this notion that God would be unjust if he assigned those roles arbitrarily to people because they were in a hierarchical relationship. So they have the same sort of theory to explain the injustice of the priesthood with respect to Black people and the injustice of the priesthood with respect to women as relying on premortal choices. Therefore, one had to have chosen what gender they wanted to be at a certain stage in the history of their own soul.
Sexual difference was salvation, you write.
Yeah, so because it was contingent, because it was chosen, not only in the pre-existence, but based also then on the choices that one made in this life in order to preserve sexual difference in the next life, to achieve that celestial kingdom, you had to behave. You had to act in the way that you were supposed to act as a man, as a woman. And if you blurred those roles, if you you know, started wearing pants, right? And there were this is in the era where women wearing pants was still controversial, right?
Yep.
If women went to work, right? If men weren't taking their leadership in the home seriously enough, then you were subject to losing it, right? You could lose sexual difference. And so all of the social and ecclesiastical and legal boundaries that were created between male and female were really fragile. And they emphasize the need to preserve the differences between male and female as a source of salvation itself, because that's what it meant to be saved, was to continue to be male and female. Otherwise, you'd lose it.
Use it or lose it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask about race, because this I was a little surprised by this for some reason, how it is that race fits into a book that explores sexuality and gender in modern Mormonism. But it's a crucial part of this. Explain why.
Yeah. So a lot of the times when people have given the history of race in the LDS Church, they're talking about the priesthood restrictions and so on. And that's a really important piece of all of this. And it plays into why Latter-day Saints were really worried about it in the 50s and 60s. But this is an era when desegregation is happening across the United States and social integration is happening. And there are real pressures, of course, being put on the ends to the bans on interracial marriage that were happening in a number of states. And Latter-day Saints ended up siding at the time, many of them, not all, but many Latter-day Saints ended up siding with the arguments that the segregationists were making and putting forward what Joseph Fielding Smith, who we referenced earlier, called a doctrine of segregation. And the worry was that if we didn't have segregation, then what's going to happen? People are going to start intermarrying. And of course, reproducing in that, right? And so the question of race becomes a really important issue with respect to sexuality during this time period, because one of the big worries that Latter-day Saints have in sort of rejecting civil rights movement and pushing back against it is that social integration is going to lead to sexual integration as well. And when that blurs then the boundaries between the races, just like they were worried about the blurring the boundaries between the sexes, when that blurs the boundaries between the races, through this kind of sexual congress that they anticipate would happen, then that weakens then the God-ordained purposes of the different races. And there was a whole racial theology that Latter-day Saints held on to during this time period of different races having different divine destinies and appointed to do different things in the same way that Latter-day Saints are thinking about the sexes as having different purposes, divinely ordained. They thought about the races as having this sort of divine destiny to them as well. And so I really wanted to make sure that people understood that the history of race in the church is very intertwined with the history of sexuality, and that the concern around a racial difference is also a concern about the problem with intermarriage.
You say that they were thought of as these divinely designed racial boundaries, and that they treated this is how you put it in the book, the mythology of race and lineage as essential to Mormonism's self-understanding. Is that what you're getting at there, that race and lineage as well as sexuality, those things had boundaries, divinely set boundaries, and you had to stay within your lane, basically?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, all throughout this period, we see social integration, of course, happening across the black and white line, but of course, it's also happening within the church and in Utah specifically between Native Americans and white Latter-day Saints. And church leaders start getting very nervous about that because, of course, what happens is Native Americans and white people start marrying one another. Mm-hmm. And they see that as really disrupting these sort of divinely ordained boundaries between the races. Now, what was fascinating to me is that for the most part, these divinely ordained racial categories don't really get taught in the church today. They're, for the most part, I think, abandoned teachings.
Yeah.
And I wanted to understand why it was that we held so centrally to this notion of racial categories and of racial boundaries and of divinely ordained ones, and then we just abandoned them eventually, right? And to understand that was one of the driving questions that Latter-day Saints had during this time period was in answering who was allowed to marry who. And they saw race as a limiting factor there. And so I saw this as a really important analogy for understanding the contemporary debates, again, today that Latter-day Saints are having, is who's allowed to marry who, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what are the categories that restrict that? What are the things that limit that and why? And so wanting to understand that the history of race wasn't just a question of priesthood or not, it really was a question of marriage for a long, long time in the church, and then just isn't so much anymore.
So you mention in the book how church leaders in this time between, I think you identify it between like right after World War II. This is a really crucial period to, in this particular moment, to around 1970, that church leaders are really supporting a marriage concept that was patriarchal, as you said, really strict divisions of gender roles and work. And you write about how Mormon leaders really emphasized this patriarchal order as being unchangeable and being of divine decree. So what did that look like? Say a little bit more about the patriarchal order. This was – and I'm guessing is this just the image that we had in the 50s of in all of American culture? The man went to work. The woman stayed home, basically. Or is it different with Mormons, I guess?
Yeah, that's very much how Latter-day Saints are articulating. And it is important to know that many of the times that we're articulating our ideas about gender and sexuality all throughout this period, we're very much tracking with other trends in society, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so just as there is a feminist movement, Latter-day Saints are participating in a broader anti-feminist movement that many other religious, conservative religious groups are engaged in as well. And we're concerned about the exact same things. So what the patriarchal order was really concerned about in the 50s and 60s was women working and working outside the home. What happened during World War II is that many women had been working outside of the home, and then they lost their jobs after the men came home. And many women were not very happy about that. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of broader cultural anxiety after the war that Latter-day Saints are belonging to. Again, the patriarchal order wasn't invented by Latter-day Saints, and lots of conservative churches are pushing it during the same time period. And they have this new division of labor that has emerged after the war, of men going off to work in factory jobs and women tending to the home. Now, this wasn't the model in the more agricultural societies that many Latter-day Saints had lived in before the war. It wasn't the model, certainly, and for much of the 19th century, that sort of division just didn't work, mm-hmm. Where men went off to the office and women stayed home. But it emerges as the new ideal after the war, again, as part of this broader religious revival that Latter-day Saints are participating in to sort of bring back some of these quote-unquote traditional values. And Latter-day Saints start to articulate then their own understanding of the patriarchal order with a lot of anxiety around women's work. There are other things that they're also worried about around men not taking enough responsibility in the home and not taking leadership positions. Because one of the things that happens when women are staying at home all the time is that then tended to be the sphere where they had a lot of influence and a lot of say. And Latter-day Saint leaders say, no. Men are also the head of the home as well. Mm. So they need to be making the executive decisions there.
Wait,
so,
really? They couldn't give women the home? They couldn't at least hand them that?
Absolutely not. They had this theory that they said over and over again that the woman is the heart of the home and the man is the head of the home. And they had this sort of emotional, affective dimension to what it meant to be feminine, what it meant to be a woman, and the rational side of what it meant to be a man, right? And so men's roles, just as much as women's roles were being constrained, men's roles were also being shaped and formed during this time period. Just as an example of this, the family home evening program is invented during this time period, and it is designed to give men an opportunity to lead in the home. Of course, what happens is many women end up doing it. many Latter-day Saints might remember that it was the mothers that were the ones who were actually calling these together. So it's always just sort of a figurehead role. And even right as the program is launching, Spencer W. Kimball, who is a prominent apostle during the time period, chastises the men for letting the women call on who's going to say the prayer in family home evening.
Wow.
Men need to take on that role. And so the patriarchal order is certainly about limiting women's roles, but it's really also about making sure that men are sort of taking the lead in the home and taking their proper place there.
So when does this shift occur where church leaders go away from seeing sexual differences and gender as contingent on the way you behave? And when do they start deciding that and realizing that sexual difference is an eternal characteristic of identity, that you can't shift it around? When does it start to get more rigid as a concept?
Yeah, I would answer that in a couple of different ways. One is to sort of trace the idea of when the notion of an eternal and fixed gender becomes the dominant way that Latter-day Saints talk about it. But I also want to suggest that it's not just a binary of either or, that there's there is always a risk and a worry about contingent gender, even up until the present day. So even though that those doctrines aren't taught, they're sort of underneath the surface of the way that many Latter-day Saints think about sexual difference and think about gender. So let me break those up into two different ways. We start to see in the 1980s official rebukes of the idea that one chose one's gender in the afterlife. And we start to see more of an emphasis on a sort of persistent sexual difference throughout one's eternal scope, from the pre-existence into mortality into the afterlife. So the 1980s is when those doctrines are sort of more and more getting consolidated in the church. And then, of course, in the 1995 Proclamation on the Family, Gordon B. Hinckley, then the president of the church, reads this official statement that makes the argument that gender is eternal and that it's an essential aspect of someone's eternal identity.
That sets it in stone, right, for Mormons.
That's when we sort of get that fixed notion, and it kind of puts to bed any of the earlier, more speculative doctrines that had been circulating around about chosen gender or not. That's when we sort of see the official end is with the proclamation. But even still, I want to suggest that a lot of the emphasis on an essential gender difference is constantly being undercut by all the worry that if we don't guard gender differences, if we aren't really, really careful of maintaining those in some ways, that they are something that will go away. So we have a lot of worry about a unisex society will result if we don't maintain gender differences. And so even though Latter-day Saints are expressing gender as an eternal and unchanging thing, in practice, they're often very worried about it being erased in some way or being weakened in some way and needing to protect it. It's under attack, right?
So that's still there. That's fueling a lot of the concern that you're getting among Mormon leaders and others about same-sex marriage and those other kind and the excesses of feminism and those kinds of things, I guess.
So feminism becomes one of the main areas that they're worried about. That then that gets transitioned onto the same-sex marriage debates in the 1990s and 2000s, and I think that we can see it today in the way the Latter-day Saint leaders are worried about trans issues as sort of one of the more potent areas where they think. See this as gender as being contingent. We have to guard against it. We have to protect against it. And so their anxiety around trans issues is, I think, an emerging area where that underlying worry about gender and sexual fluidity remains a kind of animating force of the ways that they think about it.
Let's talk about this section of the book where you explore the psychological theories that are applied to all of this, where leaders sort of start to use these psychological theories about gender. And I guess it was during this time that you mentioned in the book that Mormon leaders really for the first time started using the concept or even the term homosexual. Talk about this particular moment. This is another interesting part of the story.
Yeah. So the very first time that a Latter-day Saint leader uses the term homosexual and homosexuality is in the 1950s, 1952, I believe. And that marks a really important moment, I argue, because the concept of homosexuality is a psychological term. And it's a pathological diagnosis for a certain set of desires and behaviors and actions. Mm-hmm. And so Latter-day Saints are sort of glomming on to this. And this notion then of a kind of a pathological sexual set of desires rather than, you know, kind of aberrant practices really transforms the entire way that they approach it. It blossoms, of course, into then the church adopting psychological treatments for homosexuality and a sort of medical diagnosis of homosexuality as a disease, as something that was an illness in some ways, a psychological illness. And they had various theories for how that illness came about. And then the diagnosis of how that came about then informed the ways that they developed a cure. And so they were talking about the language of illness and sickness and cure. And so the whole concepts of that they were bringing to bear on homosexuality during this time period is a brand new concept for church leaders. And so I argue that homosexuality in the church is invented in the 1950s and 60s as church leaders start to think about it as a psychological malady. And so they approach it from a psychological perspective, and that informs a lot of the doctrines that we get from this time period around what exactly this is and why it's wrong.
You don't spend a lot of time with this in the book, but I did want to just ask you about the history. I think it might be surprising for some to hear that it wasn't until the 50s and 60s that Latter-day Saint leaders started talking about homosexuality and same-sex attraction and those kinds of things, because it's an important part of the Mormon story to say that same-sex intimacy was at least an interesting, maybe it's a controversial subject, but it was an element of early Mormonism, or at least early Mormon leaders, or at least that's the contention of some.
Absolutely. And so, you know, there's other great research on this earlier period, and Michael Quinn's book, Same Sex Dynamics. Yeah, he charts this history, tells it in a really compelling way of the kinds of intimacy that, especially among men, Latter-day Saint men were able to enjoy. And that changes with a kind of new worry that same-sex intimacy, especially among men, is evidence of some sort of psychological problem. So there's this huge sort of homophobic backlash in the 1950s and 60s. Again, not just among Latter-day Saints, but among broader culture. You've got Congress investigating homosexuals that are working in government in this time, right? It's illegal in almost everywhere in the United States. There's a huge concern about it. And Latter-day Saints sort of, again, are following those trends where we're developing these same ideas really in lockstep with the rest of society.
It's so interesting, this part where you write about how, this is how you put it in the book, that Mormon leaders are sort of mingling psychotherapeutic philosophies with Victorian sexual morality. So they have this framework. Homosexuality, they believed, was the result of this deficit of masculinity, or this deficit of femininity, or an overabundance of it. And it's this idea, to me, it seemed like it was kind of like the idea, you know, in medieval times of humors, like the body needed to balance the humors. And in some ways, Mormon leaders seem to believe a similar thing, that masculinity or femininity had to find the right balance in the body. Is that a proper analogy in some way?
I think it's a wonderful analogy. I wish I had thought about it in those terms, but that's exactly right. Because they actually have these contradictory theories that an overabundance││ of masculinity or too little of it would result in homosexuality. And as you mentioned, they are thinking about female homosexuality during this time period as well. But they really almost never talk about it. It's really something that they see as primarily a male problem. And so when I use masculine terms to describe the homosexual here, I do just want to acknowledge that I'm trying to echo the language that they themselves are developing here. But that's a really great way of putting it, because they see that the desires that one has are the results, in many cases, of the sorts of masculine practices or lack of masculine practices that one undertakes. And so a lot of the worry then for why they were worried about Latter-day Saint women going to work, for instance, is they explicitly say if a woman becomes too mannish in her practices, then she'll start to desire other women just like a man would, right? And so she'll become a lesbian. So they're really worried about that. And maybe if a husband is a sort of a weak father in some ways, or is a weak man in some ways, they saw sort of that masculine weakness is then he would be attracted to someone who has that masculinity. He's going to be attracted to other men because he lacks it in himself. And so a lot of the concern, this is why I really think that the story of women's history and the way that the anti-feminism aspects of the church's teachings during this time are really intimately connected with their anxieties about homosexuality. And in fact, they explicitly are connecting these two concerns over and over again, because the theory is that homosexuality is caused by the failures of a masculine comportment, or failures of a properly feminine comportment for women.
So there's this shift going on from patriarchal order to heterosexual order. And I wanted to ask you about that, because you mentioned how church leaders start kind of backing off on their criticism of women working outside the home, for example. And they transferred, as you put it in the book, the weight of their concern to homosexuality, to same-sex marriage, those kinds of things. And this seems like one of the themes in the book, that that broader thinking about women and gender roles in Mormonism and more progressive views about women in their role in Mormonism really comes at the expense of the LGBTQ community.
Yeah, so as those ideas we had mentioned were originally linked, and a lot of their anti-feminist concerns were because it would lead to homosexuality and vice versa, right? Those ideas start to get separated out And Latter-day Saint leaders end up being a little bit more comfortable over time with liberalization on women's issues. And so, as you mentioned, women working becomes much less of a concern. Birth control is another example here where church leaders once staunchly opposed it but liberalized. In a number of other areas, we see, of course, liberalization in the way that the church has managed its own structure. You know, that women weren't allowed to pray in church for a long period of time because they didn't hold the priesthood, right? And we see liberalization on those issues. And as exactly as you mentioned, the way that the church sort of deals with that, they say, okay, well, if women going to work isn't going to be the fatal blow to sexual difference that we thought it was going to be, there still has to be something that's the real threat, right? Sexual difference is under attack, they believe. It is something that's going to be weakened in our society. And well, what's the real thing? If it's not women going to work, which it had been, that was the main thing, then it's actually same-sex marriage now is the thing that's going to be the thing that's going to destroy our society if that's tolerated, right? And so they're able to sort of transition from saying women working is going to destroy our society to then saying same-sex marriage is going to destroy our society. But they're just transferring, exactly as you said, transferring the weight of that concern of a weakening of gender differences away from the liberalization that they were accommodating around women and onto same-sex relationships.
It's almost like they needed an opposition. They needed an enemy. And they were just sort of – there's this trade-off going on. They transfer their concern about one thing to another thing, I guess.
Yeah. If you believe that sexual difference is a contingent thing in society and that it could be weakened, it could be destroyed, then somebody is doing the destroying. And because that's a sort of fundamental concern, you can – kind of mobilize that in different ways, right? And so it was at one point, you know, fathers not taking enough responsibility in family home evening was going to destroy society, and it becomes a mobile sort of tool that you can move around to identify the real threat. And interestingly, it becomes a smaller and smaller thing, right? Just as we saw, it was all women work going to work. Now it's a little bit less concerned. Now it's just same-sex couples are the thing that's going to destroy it. And I think that we're, again, seeing some transition where we're seeing greater accommodation towards same-sex relationships in the church as a social issue, not, and of course, within the church, but in society. And we're going to, I'm sure, see other things that are going to take that place of what's the real threat to sexual difference now.
Well, what do you think that is? What's the trade-off? If now they're starting to think in more sort of progressive a more liberal way of the role of same-sex marriage, what's the transfer? Who gets to be the enemy next? Is it transgender people?
I think that that's where a lot of church concern is. So we're seeing them filing amicus briefs in a number of transgender cases. One, I don't mean to say that they have given up entirely on concerns about same-sex marriage and they're totally open to those now. But I do want to acknowledge that there has been less anxiety and less concern. We haven't heard a major speech in recent years denouncing same-sex marriage as the thing that's going to destroy our civilization as we used to. I think that trans issues are kind of taking that place. And that's, again, not just in our church, but in a lot of other church communities, we're seeing these trans issues as becoming kind of the central place where there's a lot of energy and enthusiasm among the religious right.
Yeah. That's Taylor Petrie. He's an associate professor of religion at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. We're talking about his book, Tabernacles of Clay, Sexuality and Gender in Modern Mormonism. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Cars are an important part of everyday life until they break down and just take up space in the driveway. If you can't drive an old vehicle, why not donate it to support KUER? We'll come pick it up for free, and you could receive a tax deduction. It's an easy and convenient way to support the informative, engaging public radio programs that you trust. Learn more about making a vehicle donation at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Professor Taylor Petrie. We're talking about his book, Tabernacles of Clay. Professor, let me ask you this. Just how important do you think are particular players in this story. Because while it makes sense that all of the members of the church hierarchy may have generally agreed with most of this, it does seem there were figures who were particularly outspoken or maybe even in some cases obsessed with these things. I mean, a few people who come to mind, Boyd K. Packer, whom you write about, he was quite doctrinaire about these social issues. Dallin Oaks today seems to be carrying much of the weight related to this church-wide resistance to same-sex marriage and other aspects of what he's himself called the, you know, so-called gay agenda. So I'm just wondering, how much influence can one particularly strident member of church leadership have in the scheme of things?
I would put Spencer W. Kimball in that category as well, as an earlier iteration of a lot of these and as a mentor to Boyd K. Packer.
Right.
I do think that particular individuals have played an outsized role in determining how this story goes, at least in public. There are some members of the Quorum of the Twelve who never talk about this issue, who don't seem to find it to be a particular point of thing that they need to talk about, and then others that talk about it all the time, right? I don't mean to psychologize anybody to explain it away other than that they happen to believe that this is a central issue and other members don't necessarily. Mm-hmm. Not to suggest again that they don't share some of the fundamental beliefs of some of their colleagues, but there certainly seem to be some people in the leadership of the church over this historical arc that have taken it as a larger theme of their ministry and have taken it on, and other members of the Quorum of the Twelve have been more than happy to leave it to them.
Yeah. You say that Mormon leaders have invented new doctrines about sexuality to accommodate gay and lesbian identities. Explain that for me, if you would, because it seems like seems like Mormon leaders these days have just figured out that it might make more sense to, let's work this out after people die, as you put it, sort of delaying the cure until the next life.
I was surprised at how new that particular teaching was also. Hmm. It's really not until the early 2000s that you start to see Latter-day Saints themselves, and in many ways, shows up in anonymous writings from gay-identified Latter-day Saints who are writing in the Ensign and others, who are sort of saying, I don't know how this is going to be solved. Maybe it will be solved in the next life. And then you start to see that being echoed among higher-ranking church leaders, where they start to say, maybe you're not going to be cured in this life, and maybe it'll be the next life. And that's a huge transition from the way that Latter-day Saint leaders had talked about it up until that point, which they insisted that it not only was a cure possible, but that it needed to be done in this life. And if it wasn't, then you failed in some way, right?
Mm.
And so they start to, exactly as you put it, delay the cure until the next life and say, you're going to be raised in the resurrection straight if you sort of observe the commandments in this life, right? If you remain celibate, if you repent and you do all the things that you're supposed to do. And I was shocked at how recent that doctrine was and now is really more or less the mainstream doctrine. And I think that they adopt it for two reasons. Number one is that reparative therapy practices that the church had been undertaking since the 1970s, by the time we're in the mid 2000s, the evidence is more or less in that they're just not working, and certainly not working to the extent that Latter-day Saint leaders had hoped and expected and had often promised that they would be. And so they need to sort of reckon with that. And the second is that it's just becoming more and more of a problem where many Latter-day Saints are just not accepting that these identities that they're seeing their friends and people outside the church of identifying as gay and lesbian or bi or queer, that they shouldn't be able to identify that way themselves. So they're really starting to push back against church leaders who had for a long time forbidden members of the church from taking on those identities. They said, these are not identities. These are not nouns that you can apply to yourself. And Latter-day Saints are kind of rejecting that more and more. And so I think the confluence of those two factors ends up creating this new doctrine that, well, maybe you don't need to repent of your same-sex desires in this life. Maybe you're not fully going to be able to get away from those in this life, but certainly you will be in the next one's life.
Do you see any opening at all, any accommodation for the idea that same-sex attraction is eternal, that in the afterlife, in the Mormon idea of one of these kingdoms, that people who are attracted to the same sex can just live that way and be partners and be parents and, you know, however it works? Is there – do you see any way forward for that? Because I'm just – it's remarkable at the pace of change going on within Mormonism as goes on naturally. And, you know, any sort of cultural thing seems to move and shift sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. But it seems like over the past few decades, things are moving pretty fast. And I'm wondering if you just see within Mormonism any time – you're an historian, so it's hard to project into the future, I know. But if you just take as the lesson from the history of how this has gone, do you see any moment when there might be some accommodation for same-sex people to stay that way in the Mormon afterlife?
I wish I had a crystal ball to predict right. the future. Yeah. Certainly, yeah. I'd make a lot of money on the stock market if I could, right?
Yeah.
But to answer the question in one way, current Latter-day Saint leaders have not articulated that as a possibility yet.
Yeah.
And so that's not on the horizon, I don't think anytime soon necessarily either. Is it within the realm of possibility? Certainly. It's one of the directions that the church might take on this issue. And the fact that we have seen so many changes, in some cases extremely rapid changes on this issue, some driven by official church policy and some that you just don't even notice that they've changed, right? Many of the doctrines that I've talked about having changed, we don't really notice that they changed. They just sort of did. And then, you know, they stopped saying the old thing and they started saying the new thing. Mm-hmm. And then that was just what it is.
Yeah.
And so we might continue to see some iterative small changes along these lines. Or depending on the leadership, and as you mentioned, depending on the particular personality and the issues that whoever happens to be in charge and who's in the Quorum of the 12 at the time and what the issues they think are really important. And I would say the broader context of the society and which direction it's going, those things are all going to have some influence on where the church ends up on this issue. I think we're certainly in a kind of middle point. We don't know what it's going to look like yet. Despite the fact that many leaders say it's never going to change. That's what they've said always about every change that ever happened before it changed. Mm. So we don't quite know, I think, where we're going to end up on this issue. And in part, that's because it's a conversation that's still happening in the church and a conversation that I think is still happening in society as well. We're kind of trying to work out what all this is going to look like.
Yeah. You mentioned how, as LDS leaders hold this line on same-sex marriage, that it's produced an increasing strain on some church members, especially younger members who are just don't agree with their leaders in many ways about this. And you also write this, that Mormonism did not fracture, and you say is not likely to fracture over these issues, as so many other American churches have done. And I wondered, what makes you think that?
Well, just to point out, you know, if people haven't been following the news about what's going on in the Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church and the Lutheran Church, many of the Lutheran denominations, we see churches literally splitting on this issue about whether or not same-sex relationships are going to be affirmed. And, you know, churches had split before about whether or not gay pastors could be ordained, and they had split before about whether or not women could be ordained in their. And so this is a phenomenon that we see repeating over and over again and is happening once again on this particular issue. Latter-day Saints don't tend to be schismatic, at least on progressive issues. Where we tend to be more schismatic is on people, you know, doing polygamy, for instance, right? It tends to be the conservatives who end up starting their own churches, not the liberals. And so we don't really see the kind of drive to break the church up over this particular issue. I think that what many Latter-day Saints who do want to see change do is either patiently wait and say, we'll get there eventually, and I'm willing to wait it out, or they end up leaving. And what's happening more and more, especially among younger members, is really an exodus in the church on this specific issue, among others. But this often ranks in the top three issues for reasons why Latter-day Saints of a younger generation are leaving. And I'm relying on the research of Jana Reese and others who have polled and done the kind of deep dives into the data on this. It's not just a random opinion. It's been confirmed in the data that young Latter-day Saints cite concern over the church's teachings on this issue as one of the reasons that they leave. And that's not just among the LGBT members who are leaving. That's among the straight members who are leaving the church and seeing, I don't want to belong to a church that teaches these things. So I think we're seeing a lot of strain and pressure on members of the church who are having a hard time reconciling what they see as their values on this with the church's teachings and what the church sees as its values. And that tension, how that's going to be resolved, is, I think, part of that ongoing conversation that we're having. But the friction between those two positions has got to be resolved in some way.
Taylor Petrie, he's an associate professor of religion at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. His book is Tabernacles of Clay: Sexuality and Gender in Modern Mormonism. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.